sinuses and the, what's after physical and what's not. So please bombard him with questions. I'm sure he'll give us good answers. But thank you.
Okay, thank you, and thank you for inviting us here. And so, for most of you, we are, I guess you have a talk about that. And so you have already an overview of what the experiment about, what he's asked to get. I will go briefly into some sort of behind a summary from what was that talk, and then we focus more on two items. One is how do we do the data analysis? How we identify the events and how we uncertainties in respect of measurements. And then some discussion about what can we get out of that. Obviously, we are not a vision, so we are not going into details of the models, but we can tell you about the issues that are around. And so you already know about the panel as a space-borne experiment. It's a result of a collaboration between the European and Russian institution. And there's been significant support from the Russian Space Agency that provides provided the rocket and the satellite. And the purpose is a multiple. The experiment is for study the charge cognitive composition. This is things that connect to astrophysics and astrophysical physics. So you have issues related that can give hints about the possible contribution of dark matter, like particle studies, but that's what I'm going to talk more in detail today. Maybe search for what limits for antimatter. Then things more connected cosmic ray physics, what are the sources of the particle accelerated with propagator, and also what influence the issues related to the solar magnetosphere and the Earth magnetosphere. So this is a rather wide range of measurement you can do in this panel. But as I said, I will focus a bit on this because it's what has attracted some of the attention. In reality, we are providing, this is one of the first experiments that put the magnetic spectrometer in space. It's not the first one, first one. And so we are able to produce some precision measurement at relatively high energy. And this is something rather new, also the level of sophistication both from a statistical standpoint. So, as I said, the interest in antiparticles are connected with the fact that essentially they are not a standard component of cosmic ray. Indeed, they have been detected quite later, positrons in the 30s by Anderson, but as the result of the production of cosmic ray in the atmosphere. First detection of primary, let's call it, so positrons coming from cosmic radiation. Was in the 60s, the balloon prize, and antiprotons was in the 70s. And what people think is that these particles are not produced to sources of cosmic rays. What are the sources of cosmic ray? Well, there is no clear smoking gun indication that what are the sources, but there are strong theoretical and experimental information that points to what are the supernova elements. So after an explosion of a supernova, the shock front of explosion moves into an interstellar matter, which is around the supernova, and sweep out elements and accelerate. This mechanism seems to work pretty well from a theoretical point of view and fits with what one sees experimentally. So when one sees a power law spectrum of the energy spectrum of particles, regardless of what is the nature of this particle. Protons, alpha particle, different nuclei. And this seems a fair working up to what is in cosmic rays called an E, that is a 10 to the 14, 10 to the 15 E region. So, for what concerns this measurement, I'm talking to you very well into what is standard cosmic ray physics. So, sources are expected to be supernova. And in these sources, only matter, from what we know, is accelerating. Majority of protons. Then a smaller fraction on alpha, then we have components of nuclei, then we have 1% of electrons. So antiparticles are of another origin. The most obvious one is of secondary production, the interaction of protons RNA nuclei, we went to SERAMAT, in which to interaction and decay chains, you get antiprotons and positrons. However, there has been ideas to for some primary contribution. The most sought out was antimatter production from antistar. But the issue is they are pretty far away, and how do we really reach our guys? There could be some, there are some more theoretical models that say, oh, maybe there is some lump residue from the Big Bang of antimatter in the galaxy. Also can be potential source. Or we could have astrophysical sources, like acceleration in the pulsar magnetosphere. There are definitely acceleration of electron and positron we see from photons. The point is, do they manage to get out? If they do, how they come out? And what's the energy? Or we have something else, like these primordial mini black holes from Hawking theory that should evaporate right now, or a signature of dark matter, and dark matter is what quite future transition things. So as I said, we are talking about magnetic spectrometer, because the point is to make a measurement of a charged particle. So we want to see what is the curvature in a magnetic field to derive the energy of a particle, the momentum of a particle. We need a trigger to tell us we have a charged particle. This is done through scintillators where we measure the energies and losses. We have information of the time of light because we have a particle coming from all directions. There are also a lot of particles coming from the Earth. They are called albedo particles. So since a positive coming particle coming from below has the same curvature of a negative particle coming from above, magnetic field, you need to know if you're dealing with particle from above or from below. And this is done with a good timing information. This is this is about 1.3 meters, half a tone, the experiment, and so the distance between the top and bottom scintillators to provide time of particle formation is about 1 meter. That means that you have about 3 nanoseconds for a particle with the speed of light to go through it. So if you have a good resolution of the time of the order 100 to 200 picoseconds, this is impossible. So there are many sigma away from a particle coming from below, faking a coming particle. So this, I can assure you that you don't have an issue of albedo particles. So what you see is essentially you're able to easily discriminate what's coming from above, what's coming from below. So then the curvature will tell you if you're dealing with a positive or if you are dealing with a negative particle. This is, for example, major separation between protons and antiprotons, or between electrons and positrons. But that's not enough, because you need also to say if you're looking at an electron or if you're looking at an antiproton, the main components of the negative particles, or if you're looking at protons, alpha, nuclei, or positrons. That's the main component for the positive. So for this, you're looking at ionization losses, and you're looking at identification particles through interaction inside this electromagnetic calorimeter. You have also bit information as I will show you. So essentially, the idea is to look at what happens inside the calorimeter, and also with a neutron detector that counts the neutrons produced by interaction in the calorimeter, you have a yield of neutrons that is different if the particle interacting is an electron, a positron, or a proton, or a nucleus. So the experiment is designed to do a physics that is from 10 MeV to 100 G. And as I said, to answer all these cosmic ray questions, we need to try to construct the energy spectrum as many components of a cosmic rays as possible. So this is a spaceborne satellite, so it's on a satellite. This is an Earth observation satellite, and it's orbiting around the Earth. The orbit is about 90 minutes, so it means that in a day it has 15-16 orbits. It's a polar orbit, close to polar, that means that it goes essentially very close to the magnetic poles of the Earth that are located north of Canada and down here. And this is very good for what we want to measure, because the magnetic pole of the Earth is magnet. So essentially, the pole that bends cosmic ray particles. If you are close to the equator, the path length of a particle in the magnetic field of the Earth is pretty long. The magnetic field is sufficiently strong to deviate the majority of the particle below 15 GeV. instead you go close to magnetic poles or the lines of magnetic field goes inside this, you essentially get passed on down to MeV. So if you want to measure, as we want to do, and tensor MeV, we need something that goes close to a pole. This is also why many balloon flights, where most of the antiproton positron data, went through neither in North Canada or in Antarctica, because to be very close to the geomagnetic pole. However, this also puts some experimental problems, since we go into various radiation regions, especially the most annoying one is the South Atlantic anomaly. The center of the Earth magnetic dipole is not the center of the Earth. Consequently, if you look from very far away, it seems a dipole. If you get very close, you notice that these Van Allen belts, protons and electrons, one of these, the proton one, in the South America, goes pretty close to the atmosphere. So when we fly between 300 and 600 kilometers, we cross this amount. And this is a huge amount of particles. That's obviously put constraints on what the apparatus has to be able to sustain from the point of view of radiation hardness and also from the point of view of position. And so we launched the 15th of June of 2006. And immediately after was switched on, and after the commissioning phase, we started taking data in 2006. That means that we are about 3.5 years later. However, data that we have shown you 2 days ago, we are showing you today, it refers up to February 2008. We are reprocessing now the data to include this raster. We have about 1.2 billion triggers. About 10% of this one are reported as the case, majority are a lot of parts coming from everywhere with force triggers. About 12, 13 terabytes of data. So I think I don't need to go and explain you what why people think there might be like matter in the universe. And the point is that one way to look at this essentially is with an experiment like Pamela. The idea is that some of these antiprotons and positrons could be produced by annihilation of that matter, the gas tail. And consequently, if we detect antiprotons and positrons, then we may have an indication of that. The issue is, do we have other sources? And one we know is background. And another one possible as physical ones. So at this point, one needs a careful study of the background. And then the point is to be able to separate what one sees in the antiproton and positron measurement and to try to disentangle the two components, what is definitely no existing there, and a primary possibility. Then from a primary possibility, if there is a residual room for the primary component, try to see if somehow what are the indications that could point you either to astrophysical source or to this new business. So this is the cosmic ray data as prior Pamela. And here I want to address essentially one issue that concerns experimental measurements. So that's the point of why going in space. Well, one advantage is usually balloon flight last, or to be more precise, lasted, because there have been quite a few improvements in the last 10 years, about 1 or 2 days. So that means that even if you can put up a significantly bigger apparatus than what you have in space, much cheaper, you have still a short period of data taking. So this gives you statistics. There's been improvements. For example, the best balloon flights is a Japanese American project. For antiproton measurement of low energy, it's all these measurements you see here are coming, the majority of these are coming from these best experiments. There are several balloon flights from Moon Lake in Canada and from Antarctica. These balloon flights can go up to 20, 30 days. So they manage to get the statistics. However, you have to keep in mind there are also some uncertainties. And the fact is that they are not able to reach obviously the top of the atmosphere, that is more than 100 kilometers. They usually go up to 40, 45 kilometers. So there is a residual amount of atmosphere. In this residual amount, cosmic rays interact and produce secondary particles. In this secondary particles, you have antiprotons, you have positrons. So this measurement, all these measurements, with the exception of an MS shuttle flight, 98 for positrons, add to subtract a secondary component. And this secondary component was estimating the Monte Carlo simulation of the atmosphere. And it is not, it may be a significant fraction of your signal, up to 20, 30, sometimes even 50% of the signal. So you understand that if you make a mistake on this subtraction, you can have a systematic effect on your results. Besides this, you can already can see from the data that especially at high energy for positrons, you have significantly large error bars, and this is due to the limitation of statistics. Here I have put some curves. This, I will go more in details about what are these curves. These are all secondary production estimation, according plain with the models of propagation. And this is the standard one that is open both in the literature. But as you will, I will show you some of the uncertainties related to this. And as you see, the shape here is the shape of a proton-proton interaction. So you have a proton interacting with another proton because in the standard matter, and you have an antiproton production, and then you need to conserve the number, etc. So you need to produce three protons. The proton, the antiproton that is produced as in the laboratory system, so in our system, a minimum energy of 2 GeV. So if you fold the kinematic of the production with the spectrum of the cosmic ray protons, that is a power law of minimum exponential minus 2.7 about, what you get out is that the spectrum has to go, say, this ratio of proton-proton be about relative less energy, it depends on cross-section, but it has to go sharply down for energy. So the interest of the measurement low energy is connected with the fact that there were previous measurements with a significant antiproton-proton ratio. In that case, it cannot be secondary production. Indeed, there were some ideas for theoretical models that predicted of that the mini black holes exist and they evaporate should contribute significantly with large antiprotons. What you see now is that there is not much room left if you are considering the uncertainties in the model and the uncertainties in another factor that is called solar modulation that I will discuss in a few minutes. But you see that there are fluctuations in the data. The point is this fluctuation in the data indicates primary sources or indicates some astrophysical element. And my opinion is that this is an astrophysical issue related to the sun activity.
So what's the difference between these models?
Essentially, mostly in either in the proton input alpha spectrum, for example, this work here, this one, used a proton spectrum that was about 20% lower than this other model. Then cross-section, especially for production of low-energy antiprotons, you can have an enhancement of production of low-energy antiprotons from nuclei. And then diffusion models. So how the particle diffuses in the galaxy. This example, this one here, is another model with different cross-section. The relative picture is even more complicated. So if it's okay for you, I will go into a bit of a details of the analysis. So you have a better feeling of what is the uncertainty.
So can I ask?
Yeah?
So how much modeling of the solar modulation is done in
your,
or any modeling of solar?
Yes. In here, there is a modeling of a solar, both in this one and this one. And it's done what is called a spheric symmetric force field approximation. So the idea is essentially that you have a fixed magnetic field of the sun with a fixed polarity. And is a only a rigidity effect, a magnetic field effect, that appears as a moving of particles from higher energy to lower energy with a force potential, that is these three parameters. And this is the one that includes temporal variation, because you vary this one according to the sun activity. So this is in a Parker field approximation. It's the simplest approach you can. It's more a phenomenological approach than a real physical one. However, this one cannot explain what you see down here and what I will show you about the positrons. For that, yes.
This paper by most colleagues
yes.
From, I read this paper. And as I said at the
yeah.
earlier talk, it's a complicated calculation.
Yeah.
It has 11 parameters. So you have to do 11 parameter model fitting.
Yes.
So I looked at some of these parameters and I came away with a feeling that, do I believe this?
Yes.
Has anyone checked this independently?
Yeah. I mean,
you have.
No. I'm not into the case with calculations, but there are some experimental constraints on this. And as I said, I put this one because it's often quoted in literature, but in reality, nowadays, there are more sophisticated approaches. Moskalenko instead has changed the approach. He has created this Monte Carlo software, it's called Galfoff, in which he tries to represent the wall propagation in the galaxies. He had made it available, and so a lot of people have contributed to this. So this has evolved. It seems more like a Monte Carlo for high-energy accelerator physics. And then there have been other people that have been looking at these propagations with different type of approaches. So essentially, there are many models now that indicate expectation at the Earth or in the solar system for antiprotons and positrons. But this has uncertainties related, as I will show you. What is the projectile? So how many protons do we have? What is the target? What is magnetic field in the galaxy? Where are the sources? And how particle diffuse? What are the cross sections? All these things play a role, and people have made the game trying to account for this uncertainty what's come out. However, there are experimental constraints, as I will show.
So, a lot of the input is nuclear reactions and cross sections.
Yes.
From years ago.
Yes, yes. Now, this is definitely out of date.
Yes.
Yes. But one interesting point that I will come later is that. This fraction should decrease. The reason is a physical reason. If a model of the sources of cosmic rays are correct, we have injection of particles with the same spectrum. This injection spectrum is about -2. And then this particle propagates the galaxy and they lose energy due to propagation. The energy loss of electrons and positrons is significantly higher than from protons and protons due to synchrotron radiation, inverse compton, on a microwave radiation and starlight. Usually these effects are the change the spectrum of -1. This is talking very rapidly. So we go from -2 and the injection to -3 something that what you expect from the primary electrons to the energy. What you see in the protons is -2.7. And this is explained with the fact that there is a diffusion that changes the power loss, the spectral index of the power loss spectrum of protons of about 0.6. Now, if the protons are the source of positrons, one expects the positrons are roughly produced with a spectrum of -2.6. And they're also relatively close by. Then they lose energy to arrive to the Earth. So it's the same process of energy loss for electrons. So we arrive to the Earth with the spectrum that you expect naively to be -3.6, 3.5. So lower, steeper, harder, softer than the electron. Consequently, from a pure, naively approach to what we know cosmic ray physics, whatever is the flux of antiprotons, positrons, electrons, what you expect, if a positron are purely secondary, this positron fraction should decrease. If it does not, then the picture has to be complicated. And then you start to have constraints. So, for antiprotons, as I said, we have to look at negative particles, so something that has a curvature of a negative particle, and then we are left with electrons and antiprotons, and the residual contamination of pions produced locally by interaction with cosmic rays, that we are not entering these details unless you're interested, but we can study and both experimental with simulation, etc. So then the point is essentially to distinguish an electron from an antiproton, and this is done mostly by curvature. This is sixth addition of curvature, so it means that a relatively high energy electrons will always shower inside the curvature. more than 40% of the antiprotons will not. But if it interacts, the majority of them will interact deeply. So then the idea is essentially you want to have something that comes from above. You want to have something that has an energy loss of a proton in the scintillator. You want to throw away everything that is outside the acceptance of the apparatus. You want to have a very clean track, for the reason I show you. You want to check primaries, so they have to be above the cutoff of the Earth. And then you want to throw away the electrons. For example, you can look at this plot. This is a distribution of primary particles. This is a deflection, is a proportional to curvature, and an inverse of rigidity, so it's the inverse of momentum. So this is 200 MeV, this is 1 GeV. Down here you have 10 GeV, close to zero, equal to infinity. So what you see is a very close to zero, very high energy particle, and then you go to low energy ones. However, electron and positrons, this is a beta plot, so electron and positrons are low energy relativistics, because we're still talking about under MeV, while protons and antiprotons and alpha neutrons are not. So the antiprotons are inside here. Then you want to throw away particles that are not and do not have the charge of the proton, energy ionization losses. So then you get rid of the low energy electron and positrons, you get rid of the alpha particle, and you're left with this. And then you want to have something that is not electromagnetic inside the calorimeter, and you're left with this one. So you got rid of all the electrons, all the protons, you're left with your antiproton and proton sample, for which you can immediately do an antiproton to proton ratio. If you want to look more into details, for example, in the calorimeter, we can look at what is called the energy momentum match. So an electromagnetic shower, an electron crossing one radiation length will emit a photon by Bessalon, a photon converting in a pair, an electromagnetic cascade. The energy loss that you measure in the calorimeter is approximately, if you contain the maximum of the shower, is approximately linear with the momentum, with the energy of the particle. Consequently, if you take energy measured by the calorimeter, divided by momentum measured by the tracking system, what you get is essentially a Gaussian distribution around an in value, a constant. That's what you see here. This is a negative part, a positive part. Here you see the energy. Then you see all the antiprotons that do not interact with some interaction. You can look also for some other topological information, again, in the calorimeter, where you see big distribution that is different from the positive one, and something that corresponds if you blow up this feature exactly to what you see in the protons. So this is our only indication that you are looking at antiprotons. Another problem that is what limits our energy reach is the fact that our measurements are limited by the resolution. There is an intrinsic limitation in how much, how small deflection you can measure. Obviously, if you higher is the particle, smaller is the curvature of the magnetic field. At a certain point, you will not be able to say if you're looking at positive or negative particles. And this is what you see in this plot. This is deflection again. Here, in an ideal world, you would expect the protons to go to zero. Due to the fact that you have an experimental measure of a certain resolution, some of the proton spills, moves in the positive side. This is called spillover. And so, according to how many protons you have, and how many antiprotons you have, at certain points, you will mix that you will not be able to say anymore. Just a certain good level of precision, you are dealing with protons. That's what limits the higher energy reach of our experiments, or any experiment that use magnetic spectrometer. And for us, this is about 200 GeV. So then we come to the results. And this is what we have published. Well, not low energy yet. This is the under. So you see a relatively good agreement with what was measured before, significant improvement, more than factor 10 statistically, and higher energy range. We plan to put an additional point at about 100 GeV soon. And I'm not going into detail. So this one I also show you some measurement of proton flux obtained by some of our students. This is a preliminary result in PhD thesis. And again, also in this case, essentially, you see that we have a relatively good agreement. Okay, here we go into, for example, what do we can extract from a product. I will tell you more later, but this is one first step. This is the antiproton flux that I just showed you compared to some theoretical secondary production models. And this is one work, this is Tuskin and Moskalenko, it's one of the revisions of their modeling. This is not a Galprotton model, this is an analytical approach in which they account for different types of diffusion in the galaxy. As I will show you later, diffusion, you are dealing with convection, you are dealing with magnetic fields, you are dealing with energy losses, you are dealing also with potential energy gains. So according to how you play with this, you can change significantly without changing nucleus cross-section, input proton spectrum, anything. You can definitely change the shape, especially in low energy. The effect of high energy is negligible. However, you can change the energy if you start to play with the cross-section of the spectrum. That's what these other people did. They used a different procedure, and they came out with two type of models. Well, this represent, according to them, the uncertainties in these predictions. So this range should include all the uncertainties due to nuclear cross-section, and this one, all the uncertainty due to propagation.
What is the publication?
So the solid line that is
the reference.
This is Donato et al. Sorry, Napigella, I forgot to write. It's a physical journal. So, from what we see in the antiprotons is that the shape is what we expect from secondary production. You don't see anything exceptional. There might be room for something, but the uncertainty in the prediction is so large that right, just looking at this one, you cannot really conclude anything. So there might be room for some source, but from what you see here, you don't need it. So what concerns the positron? The issue of the positron is more complicated because in here you have a significantly larger proton background, 10 to the 3, 10 to the 10 more protons than positrons. So that means you have to be very good in separating this type of event from this one. So you look at the topology energy loss calorimeter, you look at the neutron yield from the neutron detector, which is you are stuck here. Here we are detecting neutrons, here we are detecting now. So, and this is the game message. This is if you make a mistake here, then you can get completely wrong results. Since our results were peculiar, or at least different, as you know, from what we are trying to approach this education from as many possible ways as we could think of. So we look at it. We did a lot of test beam before the flight, so we went back to the test beam. We did a lot of simulation. We tried to use information from the flight data itself. We tried to construct samples from the data in flight to reach. We use standard classical analysis or a more sophisticated neural network approach and so on. At the end, we tried to have something that was essentially based on flight information. So the data we get from flight. So we think that we have that provides us with a better handling of the system. So when we can look, for example, at as you saw here, an electromagnetic shower is an extremely collimated. So a photon that produces a pair, the opening of the pair is essentially m over e, mass of electron or energy. So, and then the same is for the electron of the photon. Consequently, you have that an high energy electron when enters will produce secondaries that will be very collimated along the direction of entrance of the electron. And then you have something that will move out due to multiple scattering of energy electrons and compounded by photons. In the case of the hadron, instead, you have a much larger fluctuation both in the energy loss and in the transversal profile of the shower and the longitudinal. So, what essentially you have in an electromagnetic shower, you have a very collimated and long direction with the track that's very used. we will not manage it inside in along this direction. There is a, in a calorimetry, there is a quantity that is called Mollier rating that defines the how much energy spreads laterally in respect to the axis of the shuttle. And for us, one Mollier rating is a few strings. So if we a few strings of this calorimeter, which is segmented, consequently we can look at if you see this is a silicon plane of a calorimeter. So we make measurements of the energy loss in many strings. And if you take a one that according to the tracker and the electron going through, and you look how much energy in that here and in the two other set one, and you compare and you can go down deep inside the calorimeter, compare the amount of energy in this region respect to the total, you see that for negative events you get this picture. This picture tells you this is between 20 and 30 g. More than 50% of energy, in the case of negative events, where the majority are electrons, is inside this very narrow region around the direction of the axis. For a proton, for a positive particles, that are mostly protons, is essentially nearly flatly distribution with a lot at one that are essentially in a non interactive market, that are just go straight. So, So, okay, if you look at this one, you say, I don't see positrons. So how do I get out now positrons from this? And we can go back to what I showed you before, and I can ask if the energy loss that I see in the calorimeter has to be in this region, where on the negative electron inside the other positrons. And then I need a shower that starts soon. And then what I showed you before becomes this one. I got rid of all the protons that do not interact. I got rid of the majority of the other interactions. I am left with this distribution. On the negative one, I have only electrons. On the positive one, I have this distribution. It can be more sophisticated. The way the shower develops can be approximated in many ways. Usually, there is this standard luminous approximation or gamma function. So, you know the energy of the electron from the moment from the tracker, and you can match this or what you see as a longitudinal profile in the calorimeter. And then from this one, you get down to this one. And you can keep going on and refining. And the point is that you're pinning everything else except what's inside this distribution. So the idea is essentially what you're seeing are pinning the positrons. Can we have any confirmation for this? That's what we try to do. So we try to select a proton sample to study what the protons look like in calorimeter from the data itself. So if a calorimeter 22 planes of tungsten interleaved by silicon detectors, where the energy is measured, what we did was to use the top part, so to reduce the calorimeter, reduce the top part to require no shower, essentially something like this. If you see something like this in the calorimeter, it's highly improbable that it's a positron. Only 2% of the positrons. So when you look at this part of the calorimeter, you're essentially looking at the proton interaction. And you can study the proton distribution in this region. So you limit here, because you're getting rid of this. So for example, if you go to this, looks like an electron, but it's not, because it's non-interacting in here. So then you use this part and say, OK, this is something that I can use to study my protons and how they look like. Then I will do my data analysis only in the above. So I will skip this other part and I will look only this part of the calorimeter. So I get something that is essentially consistent. This way, this one to study how the proton looks like, this one to do the positron and electron identification. The two calorimeters are identical. So it appears that there is no bias in the procedure, so then I can create my proton sample. And with this one, if I have done this, then I have a proton sample, I can train my neural network to do this data analysis, and I can get count to a picture like this one, where I have the efficiency, so how many electrons and positrons select is about 80-90%, and my rejection, which is about how many protons I throw away, that is something that goes from 10 to minus 4, to less than 10 to minus 5, I can have energy. That's what I need due to the proton contamination. And this match with what we get from testing data. Okay. However, what we preferred to do to get our result was to try to be more careful and to see if there was anything biasing our approach in this idea. So what we did, for example, is to look again at the transversal profile that I showed you before. And this is in functional reflection. So we have negative particles. This is a distribution. Here we have positive particles. We got rid of the majority of the protons with a simple Calton energy that has extremely high efficiency, but throw away more than 10 to the 3 of our protons. And then the idea is, since these are electrons, can we say that these are positrons, and here we have a background of protons? And that's what we try to do, and to get the confirmation that this association, these are the positrons, these are the electrons, this is the background of protons that we can statistically study, is correct. So, for example, this is a plot I showed you before, and this is a similar situation with a test beam, where we have a test beam, we have negative electrons at 50 GeV, and hadrons at 50 GeV. As you see, the distribution of the protons is pretty similar to this one. Does not have a peak in correspondence. So it doesn't seem that there is any strange hadronic interaction that could produce by zero in the large amount of due electron energy. Okay. However, one could complain that a test beam is not exactly the same condition that you have in flight. You have a launch detector, things change. So can we get some other indication? I told you that in flight we have also this Newton detector. So for example, this is one of the beams that we have published. Again, this is the distribution that I showed you. So again, I said this is an electron, and this is a strong, these are protons, we potentially attain here for receiver. How do the Newton detector read the loops? And this is what you get. This is a distribution of the loops, so you have majority of zero neutrons, one, two. And here you have, for this, so you have this distribution, and for this one, you have this other distribution. If you do, for example, a Gomorrow test between this distribution and this one, you get a relatively good agreement. If you introduce a residual component with this shape, you get even better agreement. This is between 20 and 20 HeV. You can go higher in energy, and you get a similar picture. In 65. So a Newton detector indicates that what we think to be positrons looks like the electron. What we think to be protons looks like something else. However, a Newton detector still uses information on the calorimeter because it got the interaction. And we have something before the calorimeter. That was the next step of our approach. Let's look at the end. The tracking system measures the passage of a particle through energy loss measurements. So what you have is ionization losses, it's a beta block distribution. Beta block has two components. One is a relativistic rise, and one is a damping due to a density effect. This is pretty large in a solid. Consequently, you get that the effect of the relativistic rise is very small, but keeps up to the relatively high energy. In fact, if you look at between 10 and 50 GeV, you look at negative events, and this is an average, is what in technics call a truncated mean. Energy loss in the silicon detectors, we have 12 measurements, 6 independent. If you look at the electrons, you get this. If you look at the positive, you get this. So this distribution is statistically different. If you go and do this identification of the peak with positrons and the rest with protons, you get this distribution. These two distributions are statistically different. This one is compatible with this one is compatible with this one. Higher energy, 15, 20 G, same game. Only the two distributions start to get close. You go up again, the effect of relativistic crisis disappears, you cannot use it anymore. However, the point of this one is that what we call in the calorimeter positron, it was also something that looked like an electron in the tracking system. This is essentially independent of what the calorimeter tells. In our opinion, this is another strong statement that that the association of this peak that we see in the positive distribution, this one, are positrons and the rest are proton is correct. So then the point is to estimate the two components. So when we go back to the game that I showed you before, dividing the color in 30 parts, and then this is what I showed you before for a negative and positive, and this is what you have if you use this proton selected in the simple way that I showed you before. So as you see, again, you can use, for example, a gamma function. You can fit this to the distribution. And then the positive one is a sum of the proton and the electron one. And from the way, and you can play with the weights to get an estimation of the amount of positrons in the distribution. You can do between 20, 30, you can do between 28 and 42. Yes?
So if you do an estimation of the bottom graph, some kind of confidence level?
Yes.
What's the difference between plus and three? You should be
yes.
able to...
Yes, in fact, in our results, we include the uncertainty in the error bar that we put. It's not only the statistical measurement, but it's also the uncertainty in the fluctuation of the distribution at one sigma level. And this, that's what we get. So this error that I show you accounts for all this. So the point of this long discussion was essentially to try to explain you everything we did to understand if our positron signal is contaminated by something else or not. And we couldn't come out with, we have no indication that what we call positrons are not positive. Consequently, we have to accept what we see in the data. And what we see in the data is something that is rising at high energy as different from previous measurements at low energy. In here, I add another recent measurement of balloon factor response. And one of the problems when you want to interpret this result is why is it different at low energy? Finally, in the 90s, we had a few balloon flights and one shuttle mission that gave the same result, different from what was happening before. And now we contradict things. And what we think that we are seeing here is an effect of solar modulation that is not explainable with this force field approximation. The solar modulation is the sun, magnetic field of the sun, has a cycle of 11 years. It goes from maximum to a minimum. You can look at the sunspots, and in correspondence with maximum sunspots, you have usually a minimum of cosmic rays. Usual monitoring in the last 15, 60 years of cosmic rays has been done with neutron monitors on ground. So you look at how many neutrons are produced in the atmosphere by cosmic rays. And you see a minimal correspondence on maximum of sunspot and a maximum correspondence on minimum sunspot. And this was explained in the view of what we were discussing before, this force field approximation. But it's also, you also can also interpret this, what is here. This is the proton flux. Proton energy spectrum, measured by Palmer in July 2006, in August 2007, in February 2008. What you see is that you have a variation. So in a few months, this variation is explainable and describable in this with this force field approximation of evolution of the sun. The fact that there was a stronger field in July 2006 than in August 2007, when essentially it was very quiet. Now we are in a period of very quiet solar minimum. However, this explains this while it has more difficulty to explain the picture that I showed you of the proton to proton ratio. And you cannot explain this sequence. In here, I have also some balloon flights measurements that were done here in Canada. Late 90s, early 2000, and this was in 2006, June 2006, as our data. And with balloon flight from Sweden to Canada. This is not possible to explain it in this picture. So you have to think there is something else. And indeed, there is something else. Above this 11-year cycle, there is a 22-year cycle. The polarity of the sun reverts. When at the period of maximum solar activity, there is magnetic field on the surface of the sun becomes completely chaotic. And after about 1 year time, the north has become south, and south has become north. And these are indicated as a plus or a minus period. So this is definitely different. So can this different explain what we see in the antiproton at low energy and the positrons up to 5 GeV? And indeed, the qualitatively, this seems to be the case. So essentially, what would be the scenario in this case? You have outside the magnetic heliosphere, you have essentially an isotropic cosmic ray flux. Then they encounter the bow shock of a solar wind, where it takes. Now, we, from Voyager mission, we know that this is around 100 astronomical units. And in here, it starts to feel the magnetic field of the sun, that is carried, is freeze inside the solar wind. And this starts to disturb the particles. And when they enter in the inner heliosphere, in a period of, like, much of the period of now, that is minus polarity, the negative particles tend to arrive from a polar region respect to a cryptic plane where there is the sun, light. While the positive particles tend to arrive from an equatorial region. The problem is that this magnetic field of the sun is carried by particles. Consequently, you have a solar wind of particles exiting from the sun. This is the sun. And you have something that moves out in this direction with a positive polarity or negative polarity. In this case, something that moves in this direction with a positive polarity. So there is a region in which the two winds or particles carry opposite polarities. They cancel out. They create a region that is called a neutral sheet. This neutral sheet is not the ecliptic plane, but it's pretty close and has these wrinkles. They can be larger or bigger according to what strong is the magnetic field of the sun. Indeed, nowadays, the people that work in solar magnetosphere prefer to talk about the inclination of this plane respect to ecliptic to describe their sun activity. Particles that are coming here are very sensitive to these fluctuations, especially from the point of view that you have a particle that is moving, charged particle, and a magnetic field. The magnetic intensity of the magnetic field here is slightly different from the one here. Consider the positive particle tends to be in one direction, the other one tends to be in another direction. So on top of this older mechanism, which was a magnetic field, fixed magnetic field, so rigidity dependence, we start to have a velocity dependence due to this strict dependence. And velocity dependence depends on the mass of the particle. Consider it is not surprising to expect that what you're seeing be different between protons, antiprotons, electrons, and protons.
And the effect for magnetic field is that the fluctuation is getting larger for larger fields? Or?
Yes. When, in fact, you look, usually they look at the magnetic field on the surface of the sun, and they look at how strong it is according to what is this neutral sheet, as usually in the equatorial region. How much of this is inclined, define what is called the tilt angle. And in a period of maximum activity, it's completely chaotic. So this tilt angle is 90 degrees. So it's absurd. Usually, in fact, in the calculation, it could say. In a period of minimum solar activity right now, it's pretty clean and uniform. And this tilt angle is about 10 degrees or 15 degrees. This calculation here, done by people in South Africa, there are a few people that have very good modeling. And this is, for example, a very prediction for the electron-positron ratio. It's easier to look at E minus over E plus. This is our measurement of energy. And you see that you look at Earth, so one astronomical unit, and you, in the case of tilt angle 10 degrees, so minimum activity, then you can look at positive and negative. And they predict a significant enlarge, even a factor 50, between a period of a minimum solar activity, A plus or A minus. However, the prediction is this below 1 GeV. About 1 GeV, the prediction was perfect. So what we see in our data now tends to be qualitatively in agreement with these drift effects. Quantitatively, it does not fit. So it means that we need to work out these models to try to fix the many parameters we define diffusion, convection, etc. So this is a very computational energy. On the other hand, it's also to say this is an interesting game if you look into these things. Now you have the data to constrain these models.
Are there other ways of constraining those models? Is this the, can you check that this is right by
Yes, there are other measurements. For example, there is another satellite experiment that is dying now, that is called LISIS. It's orbiting in this direction, so orthogonal to ecliptic plane, and it's been taking data since 17 years. It's also able to measure the electrons, E minus plus plus, can separate charge up to 1 or 2 GeV, and protons. And they also have good measurement. Then there will be in the Voyager, they measure magnetic field and some solar wind, speed of solar wind. That's what defined it. An important element in these models is where is the ball shock, where is termination shock, etc. And these things now start to be really constrained because the Voyager is reaching, is one, I think Voyager 1 now is it left the USB. So there start to be constraints. And you could think that at the end you should be able to, with enough good data, be able to come down to a good modeling of solar modulation. And then at that point, you can come back to the proto-proto ratio narrative, and maybe you're able to say, yeah, everything is okay, or no, we have something that doesn't fit. However, this could explain what is down here. Now we go to up here, and I will try to enter
it. In your previous plot, I think you said this, but I don't know if I caught it, but that when you had you have plots of the protons and the electrons for energies below a GeV,
yes,
and they were and yours and a recent thing were the 2007 benchmark below the ones that were,
yes,
higher. The higher ones are all in the same time period.
Yes, 90. This was 94. This was 94, 95. This was 98. All rather close to a solar minimum. The solar maximum was in 2000, when it was a reversal of the field. Usually you have a relatively few years period of solar minimum, then in about 1 year you have an increase of sun activity, change the reversal field, then the activity starts to decrease.
Did you expect the lower ratio prior to observing?
No, I think that was one of the problems we had. We thought there was something wrong. We thought that in here we had some contamination increment instead, and we thought that in here we would lose the positive supercritical distance. Then we start to talk, when we heard of these other measurements, but then we start to talk with these people that did the research. And they were surprised to see the effect up to 5 GeV, but definitely in the GeV region they were expected to see a significant. This effect you should really see at the solar media. Because in other cases, it's covered by the strong magnetic field. It's only when the magnetic field is very quiet, stable, that you see drift effects, because they tend to be constant. And then you have to add the result of the temporal variation. And one temporal variation is the rotation of the sun, so we have 26 days of temporal variation. So another complexity of this model that you have to take into account the propagation of this variation up to the interstellar matter. So, however, what we see, what many have seen before, so what counts also for the is that this solar modulation plays a relatively very small effect, about 10 GeV. So 10 GeV, we should really be seeing what is the interstellar ratio. So now, if we can forget about this region, we can, however, discuss about this one. So if we can explain this with some effects we're not taking account, how do we explore this one?
Will you be in business long enough to see yourself go back up again?
That's what we hope. Yeah. The point is that things and seems are going a bit different from what people are expecting. It seems that this period minimum is a bit different from previous ones. Mm-hmm. You should have already started now to increase, to reach a maximum next year. And it has not happened yet. And this is surprising. And this has happened already in the past. There are periods of, probably in another cycle anthropically, periods of called Maunder minimum, in which the sun activity stayed low for 100 years.
The weather was bad,
too. Headlights are a little icy.
So by heart. So, but that would be an idea. If things worked as in the previous 5 or 20 cycles that we know, 23, then in a matter of few months, we should start to see the increase. And by 2011, if we are still taking data, we should see the fixed ratio plot. So that would be definitely the confirmation that this is solar correction. But if this is not going to happen, then so before I give you a very simple physical reason why this ratio increasing is problematic. But now let's discuss a bit more about this curve. We have still got some time. So I will try to go into the uncertainties. And the one important one is what are the primary fluxes, because that's an input of the model. What are the cross sections? And the cross section, you have nowadays quite a few more data from that than from accelerator, but not very stuff. Primary fluxes have to rely on actual experimental bearings. And what is the picture of these measurements? And this is what we have concerning proton and alphas, which should be the one that contribute most. And these are measurements, you see, up to here essentially are direct measurements. So, satellite, balloon borne experiments at the top of the atmosphere. These are what's called indirect measurements. So, you look at the shower produced in the atmosphere from ground. These are for protons, and this is for helium. You see, there is a even if you have usually not statistical problems here, there is quite some fluctuation in the data. So it means that there are systematic issues. Even inside the same experiment, because if you look, for example, at the Arctic data, they saw in two different shapes for the Arctic one and Arctic two. This is an important point because in this model of cosmic ray acceleration, you expect that the should have the same shape. This is flux multiplied 8 to 5. So this is to give you a feeling of the uncertainty that you're dealing with, both in absolute amount, that is how many processes, how many antiprotons you get, and in shape. Because obviously, when you're looking at tensor GV positron, you're looking at 100 GV protons. When you're looking at 100 GV electron positron, you're looking at TV protons. Well, because essentially it's 10 to 1. Yeah. You need 10 times more the energy for protons to produce that energy of that positron. So this is one issue concerning certainty. We hope to be able to constrain this with good measurement up to 700 GV. This is an indication. What we see here, for example, is that we don't have a change in the shape. Because one could imagine that if there is a change in the shape of the alphas, the alpha might start to contribute more for the energy positrons and explain part of the structure. Another big issue, how do those particles propagate in the galaxy? And as I told you, the galaxy usually is represented as a disk with a halo, pretty narrow disk with a halo, where the resources are located in the disk and then they diffuse in the halo, then escape. And the Earth is somewhere around here. So you have to account for diffusion mechanism, you have to account for production in case of nuclear interaction and decay. Then you have a second production energy loss mechanism that are very important for electron and positrons. So how do we constrain this? One idea is
I thought they were upstairs. Is that?
Why are the ears upstairs?
One way is to look at what is called a secondary to primary nuclei. From a solar evolution, stellar evolution, you expect a certain type of nuclei to be ejected by stars. Then it should be accelerating. And these carbon and oxygen are endpoints of the nuclear reactions of the stars. Lithium, boron, carbon, and heavy elements, lithium, boron, and beryllium are not. So lithium, when you measure lithium and beryllium in boron in the cosmic radiation, These are things that will be produced by spallation of cosmic rays during the propagation. And this spallation helps you to define the amount of matter and the way that these cosmic rays are propagated. So if you come to a plot in which you compare the Born-Hodel carboration to reproduce this shape, constrain significantly the diffusion parameters. So when the plots that I showed you before went to protons with this uncertainty of the diffusions, this uncertainty came from the constraints of the data. So more you are able to constrain this, so better, more precise measurement you do a boron carbon ratio, and this here, down to the energy, better you are in the definition of what is the diffusion. Another thing that is again here is that we are doing a ratio. So the point is, could we have also some issues with the electron spectrum that is an input? This is work is investigated. All this uncertainty, primary cross-section, the electron spectrum. So you see, this is a wide band of uncertainty. However, the shape of this is totally defined by what is the electron spectrum. If they use a very soft one, they can even get these strikes. If, however, we go with the most standard one, then it has to go down. I can show you now preliminary our E minus spectrum, and it's more in the direction, it's very preliminary of this one. So if the rise, if you want to use a propagation mechanism or a cosmic ray mechanism to explain the rise, you cannot invoke the E minus. You have to add something else. Either you have to revise these propagation models, or you have to introduce the primary sources. If I have two more minutes?
Yeah, they went to another room.
Okay. So I'm not, as we said, we are not going into details of the model, but let me just say a few words. First one is an astrophysical source, as paper by Profumo recently was out. And
before you start this, in that comparison of the two spectra,
yes,
the difference was 0.2 or something like that. I mean, your measurement, in your next slide, you give a measurement of plus or minus 0.05.
It's very preliminary. There are some corrections. So it should not be taken by face value, but should be an indication that experimentally, no one has ever measured. Experiments that have measured the E minus never measured something so steep. Always measure something in this region. So this is a bit of a stream that they have been taking. I didn't completely agree with what we did. And our measurements will be more in the direction of this one. So the issue is essentially that it's a positron spectrum that has some issues, not the electronic spectrum. Now, what the issues what can be physical, as I was saying, there is performance, like, why do we then to look for something else when we have physical sources? And as I said, definitely one source of this pulsar. This is a work. All this work came out after our data. I want to stress this because previous work on pulsar, they are given different prediction. Anyhow, they are able to reproduce what we see, either using only one, as it is giving. The idea is due to energy losses, what you're looking at, 100 GeV electrons should come from essentially kiloparsec region. So the number of pulsar contributors are not many. There is also this work by Uperblad and Celtic, in which we also try to account for the contribution from a far away one. They claim, they're not completely convinced, but they claim that that's also contributes. So you should account also for the far away pulsar. Anyhow, with that one, we are able to, again, reproduce our.
But would they be saying that there's a directionality to these things? Or?
Yes. One point is that pulsar has been allocated in the galactic disk. So the point is, then you should expect to see positrons mostly coming from the galactic disk. To keep in mind that the diffusion path length of a positron, this energy, tens of GeV, is about the path of a few parsec. Consequently, if we are dealing with sources of 100 parsec, then this could be incomplete. But since the effect that they predict is large, then you, if you have enough statistics, you could be able to see direction. So more from the direction of the galactic plane, galactic center, less from the direction of the Hubble. Other data gammas. GRASS now is finding out new pulsars. They also should see a contribution. If this pulsar are producing a lot of electrons and positrons, then they should see also a lot of photons. But again, you should have a lot more diffuse gamma background coming from a galactic plate than from the diffusion. All these could constrain this model of pulsar.
And here, the panel is only 2 points. And really disagree with the others.
So
that's 2 points.
Yeah, in reality...
It's 2 signals.
Yes, but in reality there is no data here, see. So essentially, experimentally...
I mean if I extrapolate.
Yeah, but...
Well, 2 points.
Yes.
2 data points.
Yeah, but if you look at the experimental data point, in my opinion, there is no contradiction between them. Only that now you see what the prism measurement was not enough precision to see. Now the point is what is the secondary expectation. If the secondary expectation is this one, then we are many sigma away. The secondary expectation is somewhere around here, then definitely is complete agreement.
This thing about directionality, I don't think it doesn't sound right to it, because of course electrons are going around the galactic magnetic field. So the diffusion length is a diffusion of basically the magnetic field does a random walk. By the time the electrons are not exactly diffusing, they're just going around the magnetic field. So the electrons could actually come from any direction because the law related is very small.
Yes.
So,
yeah. In fact, there are, for the point of view of electrons and positrons, there are some prediction that says you could see a few percent or 10% of anisotropy. But I don't know this. I don't know, for example, also if it's in this case, also the solar magnetic field plays a role that could again more change. On the other hand, the photons could be a much cleaner indication, especially if there are additional sources. Gamma, for example, was discovered by Iger. It was a primary experiment. So GRASS now may find a new one. Because the point is that the good ones should be just 2 or 3. And the point is, are there only 2 or 3 or there are many more? If there are many more, then you could feel self-created. That, again, should become clear. So this is considering astrophysical sources. But considering dark matter issues, there is definitely the effect.
Yeah. So one more question. In the Gamingo, the left one is Gamingo only, right?
They just play with the age, the distance, that is not very clear. And they are energetic, so what's the magnetic field essentially?
But I thought Gamingo they actually had parallax measurements because you could see it moving in so close that you can actually see it.
Yeah, but still, they have it's no small difference, a certainty in the distance. And obviously, considering this large energy losses of electrons and positrons, this is significant. All this is dictated by. I refer you to that paper, but you will see that.
But they're not doing crazy things, they're just moving around.
Yeah. Everything that is in theory, the certainty of information available. Obviously, a problem, again, with some additional information from the last of this week, probably constraints. But this is essentially the problem that you have in this forensic model. It can really do a lot. As I said, in the old times, there were measurements just here. The first indication of Miller experiment in the 80s of some high ratio was here. Now it seems not correct, but the idea was then to fit this one. There were another pulsar. Then there was only the data of our latest M3 heater. And then we tried to have something going like this and managed to have something going like this. Now we have this data. One is to find constraints, and for a moment there are many degrees of freedom, so we can really do a lot.
So is there any hope on constraining these pulsar properties?
I think so. I think both from additional, I think depends also, for example, how is made the spectrum, the electron positron spectrum, what's happening at higher energies. All this becomes significant. If there is any direction, the gammas. So in my opinion, in a matter of a few years, the picture should be much, much cleaner than what it is.
All depend on the photons. So, yeah.
And if this is what's going on, what's so special about 10 GeV? I mean, why is there, it looks like there's a crossover between two things. The
No, in here they say essentially that this goes to zero, this contribution, they have only this background here. As you see, this background is wrong because they're not reproduced this one. So this has clearly to be changed and modulated more.
But basically, the thing that's going up is the sun on the left and the thing that's on the right.
This is this what the shaded area is the background that we use, the usual Moskalenko. So if you change the background, you should change it also in this plot, and this will also change the slopes. So all these things are tied. So you cannot change one without changing the other one. Obviously, the uncertainty in here are so many that even if you change significantly this one, you can see that. So you have to somehow manage to constrain this model. And concerning dark matter, this could be what are the possibilities? One point that we are discussing is that while there are many uncertainties on the secondary production of the proton, the shape remains the secondary production. So this brought people like Donato to come with a limit on boost factor, or clumpiness of dark matter in the case of thermal waves. And you see, according to what energy range you use for the proton ratio, became a limit on the boost factor that should be that this clumpiness should not exceed the order of 10. This is also in line, if you want, with this Monte Carlo that had the evolution of the universe, become that this part of clumpiness that matter should not be more than a few. Obviously, this is does not really account for all the uncertainties that we see. So, very simple. Another possibility is that you are dealing either with a dark matter that goes directly in E plus minus. Or this work by PTV, naturalists, etc. They account and consider a case in which there is an intermediate light boson, which can be case. And then we are able to reproduce our data and also to reproduce these APIC data, which are. So I can go on for a few more minutes.
People might start heading for the door, but I'm still
When you want to.
Yeah, I think people that feel like the lecturer should feel that they can go, but you should continue with it.
In the case of the pulsar fits, you don't need any strange boost factors.
No.
Going from P bar to E plus.
No, you don't have antiproton contribution.
It just comes out of it.
Yeah.
That's it gives a natural explanation for the difference between P bar and E plus.
So
I like that.
Yeah, because if you look at this, a formal paper that came out a few months ago is a young theoretician said, you have a source, astrophysics, you know it exists, why do you want to look for something else?
It's a couple
weeks ago. Or you can have the opposite approach, that was talking with other people in Michigan, is okay, I place just a specific pulsar where I get out my signal. So it's an ad hoc solution. I think right now it's specific. I also honestly think more in the direction of a physical source. But the game is over. And as you see, in this game, they also included this other data that is a little more experimental measure of E minus plus plus. And whether it was this work by Cirelli et al., in which they consider, again, combined antiproton and photons, they consider a low mass neutralino going in WW, and they saw that essentially it does not work. Produced in a so either you go with a very heavy neutralino in the 10 TeV region, and then essentially this is very convenient, you have pushed the increasing antiprotons of the and I think our next data point will constrain this model originally. Or you need something that goes preferentially in vectors. In this case, again, they see this strong rise in positrons, and they see also this electron signal. And we don't see anything on antiprotons. We need a boost factor, but it's not very large. So it's not absorbed.
Can pulsars reproduce this middle panel?
Yes, I will show you soon. Or another possibility is instead to skip the idea that you're dealing with thermal particles, and consider a non-thermal neutral neutralino. In which case you can increase the cross section. You still have the problems with antiprotons, but as I show you, this is, you see, it's essentially the type of increase that we have. But it's true that in the antiproton there are large uncertainties. Consequently, you can accommodate some signal, because this signal is not a peak, it's not a structure, it's essentially just a function of what of the background. In that case, you could try to have some, you would see some effect of the process. The interesting point is that in their model, this has to be of the order 100 GeV WIMP, neutralina, like. And in this case, this ratio has to decrease. So this would be a very strong signal that we should be able to see in soon. Because if obviously, if the positive spectrum change, if you have a decrease in here, then this is a strong constraint, both for pulsar from that one. So as a last comment, let me go back to this static data. And as you see, and this is the experimental data that are presented. You have to keep in mind that the real scenario is this one. So the fluctuation and the variation, especially relative to the energy of the electron measurement, is much larger than what you would expect, again, from the systematic statistical errors. So there is definitely some systematic difficulty in this question. In here, there has been a lot of discussion about the structure, no discussion about this one, but the statistical significance. So what's happening here? I don't know. And
the red points are attic, or
red points are attic. Yes, it's an issue. I think we are coming out with another result soon for another. I think last film is coming out. That's one thing that we clarify. But keep in mind, this is that we are talking about E minus plus E plus. What we plan to do is to come out with E minus up to 500 G and E plus up to 300 G. And also, probably measuring the sum of the two up to the TV with possibly better systematics of attic, because we will accompany the calorimetric measurement with a Newton detector and the tracking, the more rigidity measure. We should be able to reduce the systematics. So, all in all, I come to the conclusion. So, concerning the electron data, picture should get much cleaner soon. Both because there will be additional experimental measures, and both because we hope to be able to produce the two components, E minus and E plus. So one understand if there is really this size, if it's due to positron, it's due to electrons. If you do to electrons, what you're seeing is a supernova structure, remember. If you do to positrons, you need a primary source. And so
is that distinguish amongst the pulsar case? Can you distinguish whether the pulsar is a red?
You see in here, this is this is the model of this, again, this paper that I showed you before, that is all pulsar. So again, they mention this bump, introducing a pulsar component, a similar one. So in that model, essentially, keep in mind that it's not a sarcastic remark, but essentially all the recent papers try to match the experiment. So everything that has come out recently on pulsar, dark matter, is matching both the Pamela and the attic data. The interesting point would be to understand exactly how our signal evolves, what exactly is the attic data. And I think that will get rid of a large amount of models that are around.
I'm wondering if the mechanism, the pulsar mechanism, does it predict a specific ratio between electrons and positrons?
My understanding is to give the same amount of electron and positrons, because it's mostly from gamma conversion.
So it should do the same thing.
So if a positron fraction does not increase, it has to increase a lot to give this result. So it's down up to 0.3. So if it does not increase as much, if it does not increase at all, then these are electrons. Then this is not pulsar. If this keep increasing, then you need a model to produce an electron and positron. Then you have both pulsar. If the ratio does not increase, or if the next experiment will not shift this structure, then you are left with explainable lower energy. And you can still do it with pulsar because you just change the parameters of the model. Okay, so. Thank you for the invitation to my study along.
There were a lot of questions. I don't know if there's any more.
one comment. Extraordinary claims demand extraordinary proof.
Yes. I agree with you. But it depends on what claim we are discussing.
He's the proof guy, right?
The point is that no underground experiment has detected a whip yet.
Yeah.
Excluding Dharma, which people don't believe in.
But I would keep separated to two things. One is the positive measurement. That's the claim we are making, because we are unable to find any instrumental effect to. I don't say that it's not. I only that we are not able to find it. With all the people we have been discussing, no one has been able to find an explanation why we get this more positive. Anything wrong with that analysis? So that's a claim that I'm making. I'm not saying, then it's up to somebody else if they want to make additional claims. What you see is dramatic, what you see is pulsar, or noise, we have to revise a model of propagation or something else. So the only one that I feel to sustain is the one that concerns measurement, and for which I'm willing to discuss and find if there's any possibility to find an error or some additional check. But the interpretation, as I try to show you, is something else. And there are many possibilities, at least right now. I think when a lot of information will be put out by our experiment, by other experiments, by LSE, and so on, probably the picture will be more clear. If this signal is true, if it's due to astrophysical things, if it's due to cosmic ray physics, or if it's due to the particle physics. But it's a different point. It's not what the point that I'm making.
We as theorists could hardly accuse you of being the point of making this. Extraordinary. So if there's no more questions, then thanks once again for a very clear discussion.